Director Finume and I will certify, and then Governor Parnell and I will sign the paperwork that goes to the U.S. Senate.
The Alaska Supreme Court denies Joe Miller's election challenge. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 22nd of December. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an unusual attack leaves two sled dogs dead.
It would go after one dog, and then it would kind of take a few seconds break, and then it would go after the next dog.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Joe Miller has lost his case against the state. Today, the Alaska Supreme Court handed down its decision in the long-running legal challenge over the handling of write-in votes in the November election. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
After lower court Judge William Carey ruled against Miller, the Republican U.S. Senate candidate appealed his case to the state Supreme Court. Four state Supreme Court justices heard attorneys argue for and against Miller's complaint last Friday. The justices took the matter under advisement. Today, they announced their verdict. The state Supreme Court upholds the summary judgment granted by the Superior Court on all counts. Miller had challenged the state's Division of Elections and its newly sworn-in director, Meade Treadwell, on six counts. Miller's oft-stated goal of forcing the state to clarify its own laws regarding the counting of write-in ballots topped the list. But Miller and his camp also alleged various voter improprieties, charging that felons were allowed to vote in some precincts. Today, the justices said that they had been guided by principles that had consistently been applied by the Alaska courts for the past 50 years. Miller attorney Mike Morley had argued that the lieutenant governor and the Division of Elections decided to interpret the law by accepting voter intent as validation of a write-in ballot, rather than adhering strictly to state statutes by accepting ballots with minor misspellings of the write-in candidate's name.
The position that the state is articulating is inviting this court, in the name of voter intent, to ignore the plain standards set forth in the statute and to imply a substitute standard under the ballot. These provisions are mandatory. Ballots may not be counted if they fail to satisfy these rules. There are no exceptions to these rules. The statutes aren't supposed to be massaged to allow as many ballots in as possible.
Morley responded emphatically to Justice Dana Fabe's question.
But if the right to vote is a key right in a participatory democracy, and if the right to freely cast one's ballot is a fundamental right, how do we preserve the rights of the voters and not to be disenfranchised if we interpret the statute the way you suggest? And in fact, isn't it our duty to interpret the statute in a way that doesn't disenfranchise any voter?
Your Honor, respectfully, no, because again, as this court held, when you're dealing with mandatory statutory provisions, this court must adopt a strict construction.
But the High Court justices disagreed, saying the court must interpret election statutes to ensure inclusion of voters rather than exclusion of them. In today's decision, they said the right of a citizen to cast votes is a bedrock principle, a fundamental prerogative of citizenship, and cited precedent in declaring that, quote, the voter shall not be disenfranchised because of mere mistake, but the intention shall prevail. On Miller's challenge to misspellings, the High Court stated, quote, we do not interpret the statute to require perfection in the manner that the candidate's name is written on the ballot. The justices also ruled against Miller's insistence that only his interpretation of the state election statute ensures the integrity of the electoral process, saying that Miller's interpretation would only erode the system because it would result in the disenfranchisement of some voters with disabilities or language difficulties, and that could reject election results that indicate the will of the people. As to Miller's contention that bureaucrats or elections officials get to decide elections by their interpretation of the state statute, the justices said no. that only one person, the Division of Elections Director Gail Finumiai, made the determination regarding voter intent. Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell, who was named in the case since his swearing in, said today the decision allows the state to return to federal court to lift the stay on election certification issued by federal judge Ralph Beistlein.
A thorough reading of the opinion thoroughly backs up what the Division of Elections did, found tremendous consistency in the way that Gail Finumiai ran this election, and very proud of that.
Treadwell said paperwork could be filed as early as today. If the federal court agrees, Senator Lisa Murkowski could be seated on January 3rd, he said.
Even a contest of the election would not bar certification, and so we intend to follow that advice, go back to federal court, and as soon as the federal court lifts the stay on certification, Director Finumiai will certify. And then Governor Parnell and I will sign the paperwork that goes to the U.S. Senate.
There are some hanging threads. The justices did not include Miller's contention regarding alleged voting by an unknown number of felons, saying that Miller amended his complaint to include this allegation too late for the Superior Court to rule on the motion to amend before issuing its summary judgment ruling. The Supreme Court said in light of requests for expedited ruling, the justices did not wait for a final judgment on felon voting allegations from the Superior Court. Treadwell said today that he did not see that issue as a potential block, as there is no evidence regarding felon voting. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Senator Lisa Murkowski may have passed a big hurdle today with the Alaska Supreme Court ruling, but one thing's not changing. She's still wearing one of the bracelets her campaign designed in the fall to remind voters how to spell her name. The blue rubber Murkowski bracelets were passed out at campaign events in the run-up to the general election, and Murkowski hasn't taken hers off since before Election Day. She says she'll wear it a little longer.
It is not coming off until at least certification, but more likely swearing in. So January 5th, I might be able to take it off.
The Christmas tree in Murkowski's D.C. office is also decorated with the blue rubber bracelets. Murkowski has caught the attention of Capitol Hill in the past week by being a key swing Republican vote on a variety of issues, including her support of repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the law that banned gays from serving openly in the military. That ended today. Her biggest critic in the Senate is South Carolina conservative Republican Jim DeMint, who not only backed her Republican opponent Joe Miller, but has funded Miller's legal challenges through his political action fund. DeMint said today outside the Senate chambers that he expects to work with Murkowski in the new Congress.
I didn't support Miller against Lisa when, until she did the write-in thing. And so it appears now she's going to be my colleague for six more years, so we'll be working together.
DeMint has come under fire from other Republicans for siding with Tea Party candidates that could not muster the votes to beat Democrats in states like Nevada and Connecticut. Animal attacks are simply part of life in many parts of Alaska, but an extremely rare attack occurred over the weekend near the village of Russian Mission. A musher from the lower Yukon village says an animal he'd never seen on the trails ran through his dog team, killing two of his best dogs. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson has more.
Ryan Hausler of Russian Mission has come across plenty of moose on the trail, but nothing prepared him for the experience he had on Monday night.
I lost a main swing dog, and I lost a main leader. My main leader, Star, she won three Akiak Dashes in a row, so she's gone.
The Akiak Dash is the premier sprint race in the YK Delta. Hausler was training for it on a trail near his village. He was driving the Portage Trail and had almost made it back home.
It was a one snow machine portage through the trees, real narrow. So there's no turning the dogs around or nothing in there.
It was there that his headlamp illuminated a squat object in the trail above. He realized, to his own amazement, it was a muskox.
I've never encountered muskox before, and I don't even know what they're attitude is like.
It was a bull, and it wouldn't move. Hausler says he decided to treat it like a moose, which he's always been able to convince to leave the trail. So he tried hollering at the ox, but that backfired.
It charged. It ran right toward the dogs and started attacking the dogs and goring the dogs, and I stood there in awe for about, probably 30 seconds. I didn't know what to do.
Fish and game biologist Philip Perry says the encounter is rare. Muskox don't usually roam into wooded areas. They prefer windswept hills where they can graze and group together for defense.
They're built for cold weather. They're not really built for deep snow. They're not like moose. They don't have long legs.
Because of that, they're usually in areas where people aren't. Most human interactions with muskox come from hunters.
They all tell me, the chargers always bluff charges. And you ask them, how do you know it's a bluff? Well, they always bluff. Well, how close do they get? Sometimes you can hit them on the head, but it's a bluff.
Hausler offers a vastly different take on a muskox charge.
They run, and they put their head real low to the ground, and they swing their horns in an upward motion. And that's what it did the whole time. It would go after one dog, and then it would kind of take a few seconds break, and then it would go after the next dog. They were just barking. There was no way they could fight or anything. They were all hooked up to my game line.
As the bull worked its way down his dog line and towards him, the musher decided it was time to flee. He found the nearest spruce tree and climbed it. The attack on his dogs continued. Once safe, Hausler started commanding his dogs to run ahead. They finally got away, but they tangled about 100 yards up the trail. The muskox, though, stayed put under the tree Hausler was now clinging to. For an hour, he tried yelling at it to leave, but finally he gave up and instead tried to stay quiet. But the chill of the evening prevented him from doing even that.
I had to move around just to stay warm. Every time I moved around, he would get all riled up and stomp his hoofs and hit his horn on a little willow.
That surprises me that the encounter lasted so long, but I don't know. He's kind of treading new water. When you get one really riled up, apparently they don't calm down very quickly.
Perry says it's hard to compare this incident with other muskox encounters, but stories from other communities lead him to believe that a bull muskox can be a stubborn animal.
Things like moose or something, if you pressure them and run them off, they'll move. The more you pressure them, the more they're likely to move. And my experience with muskox, if there's somewhere that they can back up against something that makes them comfortable, if they can back up against a cliff, building, they've had them get into graveyards and are willing to fight, that's an effective defense against wolves.
The unyielding bull kept Hausler in the tree for 3 cold hours. Finally, a snow machine came up the trail from the same direction Hausler had come from.
And I was able to stop that snow machine before it reached the muskox, and I'm really sure the muskox would have attacked the snow machine, too.
Together, they turned the machine around and headed to another portage about 5 miles away. They reached the Yukon River and went back up the original trail from the other direction to reach his dogs. That's where Hausler saw the damage. Later that night, Russian mission resident Peter Minuk shot and killed the ox. Muskox kills are permitted when safety is at risk. The meat was donated to the Russian Mission Tribal Council. The hide and head were collected and will be turned over to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Now back in his home, Hausler gives his best guess as to why the bull attacked.
It was probably living in the deep snow for who knows how long, and probably, I'm guessing it just reached this nice hard snow machine trail and didn't want to move from it.
Despite his losses, Hausler says he'll still race this weekend, and he's still going to take another crack at the coveted Akiak Dash title in January. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, working to reduce salmon bycatch in the Gulf of Alaska.
Increasing observer coverage on under 60-foot vessels, that's something that's envisioned. It's already been adopted by the council under observer restructuring, which is not yet put in place.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, based in Alaska's interior, growing across the nation.
The lame duck session of the 111th Congress is over. Both the House and Senate completed their work this evening in Washington. The U.S. Senate ratified the new START Treaty on a vote of 71-26. 4 more votes than necessary. Both of Alaska senators supported the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. As APRN's Libby Casey reports, the other big item of business today was a bill that funds medical care for the 9/11 responders.
Congressmen passed around goodbye hugs, backslaps, and handshakes on the floor of the House Wednesday evening as work concluded with the 9/11 responders bill. When Congress comes back in January, it will be a different cast of characters and a new sheriff in town, with Republican Ohio Congressman John Boehner as Speaker instead of California Democrat Nancy Pelosi. The 9/11 bill will give medical aid to rescue workers who responded to the September 11th terrorist attacks. The James Adroga Act is named for a New York City police officer who died of respiratory disease 5 years after working at Ground Zero. Congressman Don Young missed the vote. His office says he left for Alaska and the holiday over the weekend. Young was one of 168 House members who skipped town early. Over in the Senate, the 9/11 responders bill was in doubt as Republicans blocked it because of concerns for how it would be paid for and then stretched out procedure. But New York lawmakers pushed it furiously and found a staunch ally in Alaska Democratic Senator Mark Begich. He cheered the bill's passage by a voice vote and said the 9/11 responders desperately need the help.
This is an important piece of legislation. I'm one of the sponsors, and I think it's important that we get it done. This is a simple issue. They got a good pay for on there. They fixed that problem that Republicans complained about.
On Tuesday, Begich railed against GOP leadership for holding up a final vote. He had harsh words for the Republicans, who he said could move forward quickly if they wanted to.
If they believed in making sure the 9/11 recipients get good health care for a situation which includes Alaskans, you know, this is a nationwide issue. It's not just a New York issue. And I hope there's a few Republicans that get off the dime and say, let's do it for the right reasons, quit playing politics, and quit jerking around senators who may want to spend time with their family on Christmas time.
Senator Lisa Murkowski said on Tuesday that she would support the 9/11 bill and wanted to see it happen before the lame duck session ended.
I have looked at this issue and said, look, when our first responders are called, and this was truly an issue of national defense, of Homeland Security, when they are called and they are injured, there's an obligation that we owe them.
Some of Murkowski's Republican colleagues initially complained that the bill would add to the debt and set a bad precedent for other groups seeking compensation. But then the price tag was whittled down, and New York legislators, Democrats, and even some Republicans, including former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, waged a media war this week that got the 9/11 responders in the headlines and the bill up for a vote just in time for Christmas. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Alaskans drawing unemployment benefits will be able to continue to apply for emergency unemployment compensation after their regular benefits are exhausted. The Tax Relief, Unemployment Insurance Reauthorization and Job Creation Act of 2010 provides for eligibility retroactive to November 30th, when the program ended. Bill Kramer is the state's chief of unemployment insurance.
With this most recent bill that the president signed last week, it extends the period in which these benefits, the emergency unemployment compensation benefits, are available to people basically through 2011. So it didn't add more weeks of benefits to people that have already exhausted, for example. It simply extended the time period in which people may claim for these benefits.
The new law extends the date to establish new claims for emergency benefits through December 31st of next year and allows payment of emergency benefits balances until June 9th of 2012. The Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development does not anticipate any delays in getting payments to claimants who have filed for them, according to Kramer. Kramer says people whose benefits were interrupted will be sent a letter letting them know how their claim will be affected. A House subcommittee of the Legislative Ethics Committee has decided Representative Bob Lynn went over the line and veered into campaigning in his constituent newsletter. Lynn admits it was a mistake to mention that he was running for re-election. The subcommittee also upheld a complaint that Lynn promoted commercial businesses on his website that might have supported his campaign. In all, it upheld 4 ethics complaints and dismissed 6 and recommended no fines. The record does not disclose where the ethics complaints came from. Efforts to reduce Chinook salmon bycatch in the Gulf of Alaska are moving forward following this month's meeting of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. KMXT's Jacob Resnick reports.
A significant spike in Chinook king salmon caught by the Pollock trawl fleet this fall had mandated consultation with federal regulators in the lower 48 and put the issue on the council's agenda. Consultation is triggered when 40,000 Chinook are caught as bycatch. Estimates of more than 50,000 kings were taken in the Gulf this year, with the Pollock fishery responsible for the lion's share of bycatch. Diana Evans is a staff analyst for the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. One of the options by the council would be to establish a hard cap of between 15,000 to 30,000 Chinook.
Once that limit was reached in the Pollock fishery in that regulatory area, it would close down the fishery.
That idea is being resisted by the pollock industry. Julie Bonney of the Alaska Groundfish Data Bank, an industry group that represents the larger boats in the pollock fleet, says a hard cap would be difficult to implement.
There's several problems with the hard cap. First off is because the observer coverage is somewhere between 20 and 30%. We don't have the baseline to pick a number in the Sandpoint King Cove area, the Western Gulf. Most of that fleet's unobserved. We're still under a race for fish. Pollock isn't allocated, and so to monitor a hard cap would be problematic because the fishery would be over before you'd even know what kind of bycatch numbers you have.
But the Fishery Council is already working on increasing observer coverage in the Gulf. Boats between 60 and 125 feet are currently required to carry observers 30% of the time. A plan already approved but contingent on federal funding would require 100% coverage for boats over 125 feet. For the Gulf of Alaska's trawl fleet, the crucial difference would be that federal fisheries officials, not the vessel owners, would decide which days the trawlers carry an observer. Vessels less than 60 feet would also be required to participate in the observer program, says Diana Evans.
Given that there's low observer coverage in the Gulf, particularly in the Western Gulf, increasing observer coverage on under 60-foot vessels, that's something that's envisioned. It's already been adopted by the council under observer restructuring, which is not yet put in place. But in the interim gap before that restructuring program comes into place, a component of this analysis would require a similar type of 30% observer coverage to be put in place on under 60-foot vessels.
She says a second alternative would be to establish mandatory cooperatives for the Gulf of Alaska trawl fleet in place of a hard cap.
This idea was not fully developed at the time that the council put this motion together, but the idea is that there would be some kind of contractual requirement that would be put in the regulation to specify what those co-ops would do. And it would be the purpose would be to control salmon bycatch. One requirement that we know would be in there would be full retention of salmon. But some other ideas might be incentives and disincentives for salmon bycatch. So perhaps the co-op might specify individual vessel bycatch rates where vessels who catch more of the bycatch either have financial penalties or, you know, other disincentives that could be developed through the co-op structure.
Whether this plan would go far enough to satisfy those concerns about Chinook salmon runs in Alaska and beyond is expected to be heavily debated when the North Pacific Fishery Management Council meets again in March and April. The Gulf of Alaska is a major feeding ground for salmon runs whose origins lie as far afield as Russia, British Columbia, and the lower 48. And across Alaska, Chinook salmon runs have been plummeting with a series of closures across the state affecting both sport and commercial fisheries. It's also becoming a treaty issue with Canada as Chinook runs have performed poorly on the Yukon River. In Kodiak, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Alaska Governor Sean Parnell is appointing Cora Campbell to head the state Fish and Game Department. Campbell has been acting commissioner since December 1st when Denby Lloyd retired. She was one of two applicants submitted for consideration by the Joint Board of Fisheries and Game. The other was Ron Somerville, a former Board of Game chairman. Parnell has taken heat for appointing Campbell to the acting post. She is 31. But her resume includes work as fisheries advisor for former Governor Sarah Palin in commercial fishing and as an executive director of a regional fishing association. She still must be confirmed by the legislature.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Fire Island Wind, offering a renewable energy alternative to natural gas for South Central Alaska. Information at fireislandwind.com.
A new look at fossilized dinosaur tracks found on the Alaska Peninsula may prove dinosaurs were roaming ancient Alaska as far back as the Jurassic period, about 50 million years earlier than scientists had previously thought. Geologists first found the fossilized tracks while mapping rocks and sandstone cliffs near Chignik Bay in 1975. Now, 35 years later, a team of scientists from the University of Alaska Fairbanks and the University of Alaska Museum revisited and studied the tracks. From KNOM in Nome, Matthew Smith reports.
Despite severe erosion and the need for rock climbing equipment to make plaster casts of the tracks in the cliff face, the researchers say the fossils are teaching them a great deal about the distant past of Alaska. Museum Earth Science curator and lead researcher Pat Druckenmiller says the tracks are significant because they represent the earliest evidence of dinosaurs in Alaska.
All the other dinosaur fossils that we know of from the state of Alaska come from the Cretaceous period, between 100 million years and 65 million years old. But these tracks were potentially from rocks from the Jurassic period, about 150 million years older. Our work was able to confirm that those dinosaurs made their tracks in the Jurassic period. That pushed the fossil record of dinosaurs in the state back by 50 million years in one shot.
Druckenmiller says the tracks are also important because of the type of dinosaur that left them.
These dinosaurs that made the tracks were human-sized dinosaurs that were meat eaters. Carnivores are generally a rare element of any community of animals. The tracks of the meat-eating dinosaurs is sort of by definition a rarer find. Just like today, you're likely to go out and see a lot more caribou and moose than you are bears. The fact that they were meat eaters was a frosting on the cake, if you will.
The team worked with the Chignik Lagoon Native Corporation and the Alaska Peninsula National Wildlife Refuge to access the tracks, which are in a remote corner of the state notorious for poor weather and a high density of coastal brown bears. The team hopes to return to the site in the future for more fossils, which may lie in the wildlife refuge. I'm Matthew Smith.
A fifth grade class from Quinnahock has gone viral with their rendition of the Hallelujah Chorus, which they posted on YouTube. After gaining the attention of multiple news organizations around the state and even receiving recognition from U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski via Twitter, the video now touts more than 22,000 views as of 3 p.m. today. No one was available to talk about the project at the school, but fifth grade teacher James Barthelman headed up the project. After the class spent 10 hours filming, it was up to Barthelman to edit it into its final, entertaining, card-flipping form. Quinnahock is a Yupik village of 680 people on the Bering Sea coast, south of Bethel. You can watch the video at our website, aprn.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. You can follow us on Twitter at aprn. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Jacob Resnick in Kodiak, and Matthew Smith in Nome. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel and Josh Edge from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. It's almost time to file online for your PFD, and when you do, you can make an impact by sharing just a little with a cause you care about. Celebrate the arts, invest in education, shelter a homeless pet, lend a hand, or even make a wish come true when you pick, click, give to one of Alaska's nonprofits. Visit pickclickgive.org to decide how you will make Alaska better with a small gift from your PFD. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation. ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, has been asked to administer the new temporary federal insurance program that allows individuals with a qualifying pre-existing condition and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months an opportunity to purchase health insurance. Capacity is limited, so contact an insurance broker or ACHEA immediately. More information at achia.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.